it up a little. I think we're ready to start now. I think I'd like to tell you why I got involved in the history of the Daughters of Bilitis as a beginning. When I first began to work my way into being a lesbian, into accepting my feelings and was coming out, I came out in San Francisco, and I was referred to the Daughters of Bilitis. I was told, well, you know, there's a lesbian organization. So when I walked in through the door, the first thing that caught my eye was the publications rack. The rack was just full of women's publications from all over the United States. There were copies of Sisters, and there were copies of the Ladder, back issues, old back issues, and I was just fascinated by them. And one of the first things that I did was to pick up those back issues of the Ladder and start reading. I was kind of looking for a background, a historical sense of where we were coming from and what had happened, how we had gotten to where we are today. And the more I read, the more fascinated I got, and I just wound up going through a lot of the old documents and talking to some of the women that started DOB and finding out how it happened. And I found out that that's one reason why I titled my presentation the way I did. What happened after we came out of our closets, or which way is the street? We didn't come out of our closets and onto the street. It was a very gradual growth, a very gradual building. DOB started back in 1955, and at that time we had just finished with the Korean War and McCarthyism, the witch hunts in the armed forces. We were dealing very heavily with gay bar raids and being thrown in jails, and it was very closety. It was very rough being a lesbian, much less being an out-front lesbian. And DOB started with a group of eight women who were looking for an alternative to the bar scene. They wanted a place to meet that wasn't crowded, that wasn't noisy, that was open to more than just a small group of friends. Because at that time in San Francisco, a lot of women made connections with each other and formed small groups of about 6 to 8 couples. And they would meet in each other's houses and play Scrabble and Monopoly and Bridge and so on and so forth. And a group of them were talking, and they decided, well, you know, let's try it and see what happens. And they began with potlucks in their home. There were originally 8 of them. There were 4 couples. There were 2 couples, and there were 4 women who were unattached. It's also interesting to note the way that they broke down. 4 of them were professionals. 3 of them were minority women, third world women. The remaining one was Jewish, I think. I'm trying to remember. I learned so much in the last 2 years of reading and listening to the women that started this. They really wanted to get it off of the ground. They did an awful lot of babysitting. Come and join our organization, and we'll come and pick you up, and we'll feed you, and we'll take you home, and, you know, please don't be afraid, and so on and so forth. It was really difficult establishing ourselves as a cohesive group, and nobody really wanted to be out front about it, and nobody wanted their name printed. They started a small newsletter, which they did call The Ladder. Well, I should back up a little bit and tell how we got our name. Back in the 1920s, which was the last time we had any kind of a gay movement, and most of that was composed of rich lesbians in the United States who moved to Paris, and that was Gertrude Stein, Juno Barnes, Alice B. Toklas, and several other women, went to Europe and were part of the homophile movement, which was very strong then. There was one in Germany. The Netherlands was very well organized. England had several small organizations going at that time. And they all went over there and did their thing over there. One of the salons there was, I forget the name of the woman who ran it, but there was a poet there, a gay poet, by the name of Pierre Louis, who wrote a book called The Songs of Bilitis. Bilitis, historically, is believed to be one of Sappho's lovers. The name, the Daughters of Bilitis, was suggested by Maria, who was a Mexican gal who said, explained who Pierre was and the poems that he had written, and she said, and that'll really sound, you know, kind of like the D.A.R. or... and it'll really sound very conservative and middle of the road, and it won't frighten everybody off. So that's what they did. That's how we got our name and why we chose it, so that women could belong to it and say that they were going to a Daughters of Bilitis convention or meeting or whatever, and they could say, oh, well, it's just a social service organization that we belong to. And that made it fairly comfortable, even though women were still afraid to go to a private home even to have a meeting. The concept of the ladder came from two women who were really into publishing, really into printing up what was going on and trying to find more women across the United States. In 1956, they started publishing the ladder, and the design, I'd hoped to bring some slides, and I couldn't get it together to do that. I don't have a camera, I just couldn't find one to do it. But the ladder was originally looked like this. This is volume 1, number 10 from 1957. It shows a line of women climbing up a ladder. The idea was that we were climbing up out of our oppression, that we were climbing up out of our closets and reaching for a better world, reaching for a better way to live in society. The history of our words that have been applied to gay people, is very interesting, and I'd like to read you some of the purposes of the Daughters of Bilitis at this time. The language is kind of funny, but at the same time, it's kind of scary, too. The purpose of the Daughters of Bilitis, a woman's organization for the purpose of promoting the integration of the homosexual into society by 1, education of the variant, with particular emphasis on the psychological, physiological, and sociological aspects, to enable her to understand herself and make her adjustment to society in all its social, civic, and economic implications. This to be accomplished by establishing and maintaining as complete a library as possible of both fiction and nonfiction literature on the sex deviant theme, by sponsoring public discussions on pertinent subjects to be conducted by leading members of the legal, psychiatric, religious, and other professions, and by advocating a mode of behavior and dress acceptable to society. This is where we began. This is 1957. This is volume 1, number 10 from July. At that time, the offices were President Helen Sanders, Vice President Del Martin, Secretary Marty Elliott, Treasurer Tony Navarro, and the Publications Director was Phyllis Lyon. Editor of the latter at that time was Phyllis Lyon, Del Martin. Jay Bell was handling circulation. Helen Sanders was doing the production. And Sten Russell was a Los Angeles reporter. I'd like to read an article in here. It's a very short one. It's titled, Which One Has the Tony? It's a quote from two different magazines from this time period. On the August newsstands appear two magazines with articles which purport to describe the female homosexual for the lay reader. The two conceptions are of extreme interest. According to Hugh Barnes, M.D., in an article entitled, What Makes a Homosexual? In the magazine Actual Medical Cases... Hang on. It's a good one. The homosexual female is characterized by deficient fat in the shoulders and at the girdle, firm muscles, excess hair on the chest, back and legs. Checked your back lately? A tendency to overdevelopment of the clitoris. There is also a tendency towards a shorter trunk, a contracted pelvis, underdevelopment of the breasts, excess hair on the face, and a low-pitched voice. Edward Dengrove, MD, offers a slightly different picture of his presentation of homosexuality in women in the August issue of Sexology. This is 1957. That's not too awfully far from us. According to him, he says, contrary to the popular conception of the woman with homosexual tendencies, she is not necessarily, or even usually, the extremely masculine woman. Aggressive, strong, and muscular, mannish in physical appearance and dress, lacking all the delicacy and gentleness we associate with the feminine. As a matter of fact, she may be the most feminine of women, and many lesbians actually accentuate their female charms the better to attract the kind of woman they want as a sexual partner. For most lesbians are not women who are pretending to be men, but rather women who cannot express their normal sexual drive in relationship to men, but must direct it towards other females instead. Even in the sexual sphere, the lesbian remains essentially feminine, with the natural desires and reactions of a woman. There is a small group of lesbians whose sexual inversion does arise out of their attempt to live the part of a man. These are the lesbians who dress and behave as much like men as they can, although not all women who do so are homosexual by any means. So here we have two different views of gay people. And the words I find very, very fascinating from that time period are the deviant, the invert, the pervert. The whole idea of the way that we were thought of and written of and the way that we thought and talked of ourselves at that time. And the normality, unable to express our normal sexual drive, is very fascinating. And I had a lot of fun tracing our words as we progressed. This is from 1957. We did finally manage to get quite a few women out of their closets. As the word spread that there was a place to go besides the bar culture and that anonymity, which was very important at that time, would be protected, more and more women began coming around to see what was happening. By this time, they had raised enough money to open a small office and had begun to sponsor some research. We were having a terrible time from the medical profession and the American Psychiatric Association. And an angel came by the name of Blanche Baker, who was a doctor. And from what I can understand from women who knew her, she was really wonderful. She took the responsibility of being really upfront and really sponsoring and doing hard, what we call hard research, and began turning out results. As women began to find out that we had or were publishing the latter, we began to get requests from all over the United States saying, you know, here's my money, you know, does it come in a plain brown wrapper? Hide my address, but don't forget it. If you can find a way to mail it to me without mailing it to me, please do. And so on and so forth. And as we moved on into opening an office, an actual honest-to-God office with a public telephone number, women began to call. And women began to express their loneliness and their isolation and their want for being accepted by society. At that time, we would be very, very happy just to be tolerated. You know, we're sorry we're sick, but, you know, put up with us because we can't help it. And this was a very common attitude during this time period. As research began to grow, women began answering the questionnaires that were sent out and cooperating very extensively with people who would come along. We were very, very anxious. Anybody who came along and wanted to do research, we were really happy to hear about that. But the DOB chapter in San Francisco at that time was by itself. There were only two other gay organizations at that time. There was one incorporated down in Los Angeles, and there was the Mattachine Society, which formed back east in Washington, D.C. One incorporated in the Mattachine Society were mainly formed by men. There was a lot of participation by women in both organizations on almost all the levels. At that time, we were very, very few of us were out of the closet at all. We were just happy enough to find other people to talk to. But as time progressed, we got kind of lonely, and we began encouraging women who were in their own area. We would get letters, like from New York City, which was our first sister chapter. We had quite a stack of subscriptions for the latter. We had quite a stack of requests. You know any women in my area? I don't know any gay people. I don't know where the bars are. Please, you know, at least tell me where the bars are. And we would do that. We formed a reference, Rolodex reference, which had a list of all of the gay organizations we knew of and a list of all of the bars and social places around the country that we could get. So we wrote several women in New York, and we said, hey, why don't you form your own DOB? Do your own Daughters of Belitis. You know, it's a nice, cool way to do it, and you can begin setting things.